Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 26. A Room with a View. It was a small room, mostly full of dusty cardboard boxes. There was an old dresser on one side and a metal fold-down bed up against the wall. John walked over to the paper shade that covered the front window. He pulled it down slightly and then let it go so it rolled to the top, letting sunlight fill the room. Dust from the shade filled the air. "Let's get some fresh air in here," John said, reaching for the latch on the window. He turned it with one hand and pulled the window open with the other, sneezing loudly.
"Gesundheit," I replied.
"I haven't been in here for a long time," John said. "We can stack some of the boxes on top of each other. That will give you more room." He reached down and strained to pick up a heavy box. "These are old records," he continued, "old 78s. Let's stack them along that wall." It didn't take long to move the 30 or so boxes out of the way. Then John swung the metal spring bed into the middle of the room. "Now, if I remember right," he began, "this bed springs out dangerously when the latch is open. You grab one side and I'll get the other." We positioned ourselves to avoid injury and John pushed open the latch. The mattress forced the springs down and we guided it into place. John tested the mattress with his hands.
"Still good," he declared. "Try it out."
I moved to the side of the bed and sat down. Then I slowly swiveled and stretched out. The end of the bed at my feet hovered a few inches off the floor.
"Oh, I forgot about that," he said. "It's a little cattywampus. You have to put some books under the legs to level it out. You can use any of the books in that pile on the floor. Otherwise, you will be sleeping either uphill or downhill all night."
I carefully swung my feet off the side of the precarious bed and stood up. John pulled a couple of books from the stack in the corner of the room.
"Here, Milton's Paradise Lost and Dante's Inferno ought to level the legs out. You'll have plenty of demons under your bed," he chuckled.
He bent down slowly and placed Paradise Lost under one leg, then moved to the other side and put Inferno under the other.
"There."
Willow had been sitting by the door, observing our activity. She came over and jumped into the middle of the bed.
"Well, it looks like your dog is at home," John declared as he reached over to pat her head.
Willow sat up, wiggled her nose, and let out a tiny sneeze. I soon followed with one of my own.
"I've got broom and some dust rags," John said. "It won't be so bad when you clean it up a little. In fact," he added, fishing for his keys and moving toward the door again, "I might have what we need right here. Follow me."
Just outside the room was another door, secured with a padlock. John inserted a key and opened it with a click. He turned another key in the door lock and opened the door.
"My treasure room," John said. He switched on a small overhead chandelier.
My eyes widened at the sight of dozens of antique Victrolas, with horns in many shapes and sizes, sitting on tables and on the floor.
"I must trust you," he said. "I don't show this to everyone."
There was one massive Victrola sitting on the floor. It had an off-white horn that must have been 3 feet long.
"So this is what the records are for," I said.
"Yes, I collect these. They are my babies," John said, spreading out his hands. "Most of them were broken when I bought them. I stole parts from some of them to get the others working."
"They are fantastic," I said,
marveling at the collection and contemplating the irony of a man with such poor hearing in one ear being a collector of Victrolas.
"My mother got me my first one when I was a kid," he said. "It had a dog on it, like that one over there. You know, the Victrola dog?"
"Yes, I remember that dog," I said. "She used to play Benny Goodman records on the big machine in the living room, and she would dance with me when I was about that high." John held his right hand about 3 feet off the floor. "She was a wonderful woman. I still have that one in my bedroom. I play it at night when I go to sleep. I have good memories here."
"So you said you were born here?" I asked.
"That's right. Right downstairs in the kitchen," he confirmed. "There was only one bridge in town then, the Manette.
The hospital was on the other side of the water. The bridge was closed for repairs, and there was no way to get to the hospital, so the doctor came here. The only time I've been away was 2 years during the war. I lost most of my hearing in this ear, and my eye was damaged by a grenade, so they shipped me home. John stepped up to the closet door and opened it. It was stuffed with boxes piled on top of each other. He found a broom and a dustpan and handed them to me. "These are a little worse for wear, but they'll do the job." "So, is this really the only house around here?" I asked. John stood and nodded. "I've seen a lot come and go," he said. "The city got bigger, then smaller, then bigger, then smaller again. I played my trombone when 6,000 sailors came, and I played it when 6,000 sailors left. This street used to be lined with homes. Now I'm the last holdout, the last of the Mohicans, you could say. I spent 20 years taking care of my mother here before she died. It took me 6 years to clean the things out of her room. I'll probably die here too." I honored the quiet, distant look on his face. After a moment, it shifted. "Let's go get that room cleaned up," John said, heading for the door. "Oh, here are some old holy t-shirts you can use for dusting." He picked up some rags from the bookcase by the door. "Oh, wait, I've got to show you this." John picked up a small box from the top of the dusty bookcase. He held it carefully in his hands and pushed something on the bottom. The top of the box slowly opened and a small red bird rose into view. "These boxes are rare," he said, pointing, touching the bird with his little finger. "Those are real feathers." "Amazing," I said. Then John placed the wooden box gently back on the bookcase, and we moved out of the room. He locked the door and put the padlock back in place, snapping it closed and pulling on it to make sure it was secure. We went into the front bedroom, and John went right to work sweeping the floor while I dusted. "You might want to put some cotton in your ears if you want to sleep tonight," he said, as the broom swished across the floor. "A ship is in with lots of sailors on it. On top of that, it's Friday night and a holiday weekend." A few minutes later, John swept the last dirt into the dustpan and placed the broom against the wall. "Well, I've got to get going," he said. He pulled out his key again. "Here's a key to the front door. Don't forget to lock it on the way in and out. And here's a key to this room." He handed them to me. "I'll see you later." I nodded my thanks, accepted the keys, and kept on dusting. John's feet made a strange stomping sound as he went down the stairs. I heard the rattling of his keychain and, minutes later, the sound of his Volkswagen bus coughing and spitting as he fired up the engine. I spent almost another hour cleaning, then decided to take a break and go for a walk in the park with Willow. We stopped at the library to read the daily papers and stopped by the local church for a much-needed evening dinner before heading back to John's house. I walked into the Salvation Army parking lot about 6 in the evening to get my sleeping bag from the van, just in time to see James and AP straining as they lugged an old floral print sofa down the alley. "Put the goddamn thing down for a minute," AP yelled. "I need to catch my breath." "We only got a few more yards to go," James panted back. "I'm putting my end down now." AP dropped the heavy sofa to the pavement. "Oh, man," James whined, momentarily hanging on, but then letting go of his end with a thud. "We were almost there." As I walked toward them, I saw their friend Brian around the back corner of the 7-Eleven, carrying two wooden armchairs, and Robert, another regular at Sally's, toting a couple of wooden shipping pallets. James took off his weathered baseball cap and wiped the sweat off his brow. He spotted me as he looked up. "Richard, Richard," he said, waving me over to them. "Look, we scored a sofa and some chairs. They had a one-day garage sale up the street, and they said we could have these if we carried them away." I looked at the sofa. There was a large rip in the material on one side, and the cushions were threadbare in many places. I asked an obvious question. "What are you guys going to do with them?" "We're going to sit on them," James replied, in an equally obvious answer. "Where?" I asked. "Right over there,"
James replied, pointing to a spot behind Sally's where the men hung out.
Okay, but you know the Major won't go for that, I cautioned.
Hell, they're gone for the weekend, AP offered. It's a holiday, man, Labor Day. They won't be back till Tuesday. We can party till then.
Brian and Mike had caught up with AP and James and were now supervising the operation.
Let's go, AP said to James. He leaned down to pick up the sofa. James did the same. They put their hands under the bottom and lifted with audible grunts. I watched as the two men carried the sofa the final few yards and then, in unison, dropped it in the dirt.
Let's face it that way, James said, pointing to the cement wall and beginning to tug on the end.
It's okay like it is, AP said, sitting down on his end.
But it would look better if we faced it that way, James insisted.
Okay, okay, AP grudgingly stood up. The two men then spun the couch about 45 degrees, looked at it, and then plopped themselves down, one on each end.
I'll start a fire, Brian said, lifting one of the wooden pallets he had tossed to the ground. He got a good grip and tried to remove one of the slats, to no avail.
You guys got an axe? He asked.
We ain't got no tools, James replied. Brian tossed the pallet to the ground, raised his leg, and stomped on the slats with his boot, loosening a couple of them enough to twist them off.
Did you check for spare change behind the cushions? I asked AP.
Man, we did that half a block away from the house, AP said. Just a couple of candy wrappers, though, that's all.
Brian continued to stomp and break wood away from the pallets, and Robert began collecting the wood as AP and James looked on.
Man, I'm thirsty, James said, getting up off the tattered sofa and walking down the old wooden steps that had once served as the back entrance to Sally's, now boarded up. He got on his hands and knees, crawled partway under the steps, and pulled out a large black plastic bag, which held their stash of refreshments for the night, a case of Rolling Rock.
Bring me one, AP called out, followed by a me too, and an I'll take one from Brian and Robert.
James pulled out four bottles and delivered one to each of his buddies.
Well, it looks like you guys are set for the night, I said.
Brian took a swig of his beer and set it on the ground. He made a small teepee out of the pieces of wood that he had splintered off the pallet. Then he got down on his knees, leaned forward with his lighter, placed the flame near the splinters of the wood, and blew gently. Slowly, the small pieces of wood began to burn.
I'm a good fire builder, he said, as the fire began to grow.
He placed a few larger pieces of wood on top of the small blaze.
And there are two or three more pallets behind the 7-Eleven we can get later, he added, picking up his beer and sitting down on one of the chairs.
I'll see you guys later, I said, excusing myself. I got my sleeping bag and made sure my vehicle was locked up tight before heading off. Willow and I walked over to John's house for the night. There were three people talking on the front steps of the house as I approached. I had seen them all before. The woman took a deep drag off her cigarette and then flicked it out into the street.
You the new guy?
She asked as I moved closer, carrying Willow.
Yeah, I'm Richard, I replied.
I'm Lisa, she said. This is Steve and this is Don. We all live here.
I nodded at the guys and said, This is my dog Willow. I put her down on the sidewalk but watched her carefully. It was only about 10 feet from the front steps to the street, which was now humming with traffic.
Is John here? I asked.
No,
Lisa replied. He took one of the other guys to Seattle.
He's had a toothache for a week or more, and he moaned most of the night last night. So John took him to the university over there. It's about the only place he could go. He doesn't have any money. John found out they will pull it for free at the dental school. Nobody would do it over here. They didn't leave until 2, so I don't expect him back till late.
Well, glad to meet you, I said. Come on, Willow, I called, and we moved up the steps. I unlocked the door, climbed the stairs, unlocked the door to my room, and tossed the sleeping bag on the bed. I quickly unrolled it, and Willow hopped up on the bed. The room was stuffy, so I opened the window about halfway. I peeked out at the lights from Monica's across the street. There was a neon Budweiser sign glowing in one window, a Coors sign in another, a Lotto sign filling a third, the latter serving as a spotlight for a pull tab banner. To the right behind the signs, I could see the silhouettes of men playing pool. At the other end of the building, I could see the outlines of people sitting at stools at the bar. Four sailors were walking briskly toward the front door in their dress whites. They were laughing as they walked into Monica's one by one. The neon lights illuminated their uniforms. Once inside, they headed for the bar and then blended into the crowd. Well-dressed men and women began walking down the sides of the street. An older gentleman wearing a Stetson hat was walking arm in arm with a woman carrying a single long-stem rose. I guessed they were going to see Kenny Rogers. I had seen the announcement on the marquee of the old theater at the corner of Fifth Street, just a block and a half away, the one that had been remodeled into a dinner theater, a distant reminder of my former life. People were parking in the bank parking lot, kitty-corner to Sally's, and walking to the theater. As I glanced that way, I noticed that the crowd had lured A.P. and James off their comfy sofa. The boys were smiling and joking and panhandling as the well-heeled theater-goers trooped by. A.P. was playing to the crowd. He was shuffling his feet and cocking his head from side to side as he delivered his routine, trying to pry a dollar or two from their pockets. I imagined he was telling one of his jokes and asking for 87 cents. I wished him well and watched as the man shook his head, but his mate reached into her purse. I saw a profile of a man who looked strangely like C standing on the corner wearing a rumpled raincoat and a round golf-style cap. He wore dark glasses and held a white and red cane in one hand and a cup in the other. He was tapping his cane on the sidewalk and saying something I was much too far away to hear. The strains of Willie Nelson singing Georgia were coming from the jukebox, and the sound of laughter and the clatter of pool balls clashing on the break were coming from the social club. For a few moments, it felt like I was in New Orleans as I peered from this Victorian window, watching the well-dressed, passing by the poor folk, on the street. Just then, four motorcycles sped by, filling the air with noise. I pushed the window down a little, pulled down the paper shade, and moved over to the bed. I kicked off my shoes and climbed into my sleeping bag. I was tired, and a good night's sleep in bed, albeit a precarious bed held in place by Dante and Milton, was both needed and welcome. It didn't take but a minute for me to drift off. The sound of voices and the flashing, spinning white and blue lights penetrating the paper blind jolted me from my slumber. I discerned distinct conversation from the porch below. "They're going to nail his ass!" This was followed by the sound of laughter. I rolled over on my other side, hoping the sound and the lights would go away. "The stupid guy has a headlight out," another voice said, again followed by laughter. I slowly got out of bed and walked to the window. I pulled back one side of the blind just to take a peek. The flashing lights of the two police cars were mingled with the hues of all the beer signs at Monica's. The police had pulled over an old yellow Buick right in front of the social club. Two men were in the car. "You know them, Donnie?" I heard a woman's voice ask. "No," came the reply. Just then, the shrill sound of a siren silenced the voices. Another police car sped past the window going in the opposite direction, its blue and white lights flashing and its engine roaring. I glanced up the street to see three figures, dressed in black, standing under the light of the old big red cross mounted on the side of the Salvation Army building. The police officer on the driver's side of the old Buick stepped back as a young man in a baseball cap, T-shirt, and jeans got out of the car. He walked to the trunk and opened it. Another young man climbed out from the passenger side. Two officers stood at alert while the other two began to search, one looking in the trunk and the other in the glove box and the back seat. Whatever the officers had found warranted an arrest. The driver turned, placed his hands on the car, and spread his legs. The other man leaned on the police cruiser. They were both quickly cuffed and searched. "Boy, I don't need a TV here," I thought. It's like Law and Order for real. The police guided the two men into the back seat of their cruiser. To add to the light show, a tow truck pulled up with its red lights flashing. In less than 10 minutes, both police cars had pulled away and the truck had loaded its charge and pulled off the Buick in tow. With all the extraneous lights now removed, I could see the flying sparks and the glow of the fire being enjoyed behind Sally's by AP, James, and the boys. The teenagers had just begun to walk down the street toward Monica's when I saw Brian around the corner of Monica's parking lot. He was barefoot and shirtless and wild-eyed, carrying what appeared to be an automobile flare in one hand. The young man in black took one look at Brian and moved quickly across the street in front of John's house. "Look at that," a voice from below said. "He's completely wasted. He doesn't even know where he is." Then a woman came rushing out of Monica's and headed for the parking lot. A man was not far behind. She was reaching in her purse, apparently for her car keys, when he caught up with her. "You bitch!" he roared, grabbing the woman by her shoulder and spinning her around. "Get away from me, Jason!" she screamed back. "I'll call the cops!" "Go ahead, bitch!" he yelled, pushing her against the car. "Hey!" This new voice was coming from a woman on the porch right below me. "You can't do that!" The man looked across the street and glared. "Mind your own business," he screamed. "We'll call the cops if you push her again," came the warning from below. The man stepped back, and the woman, crying and shaking now, put the key in the lock of the car and opened it. She quickly got in and started it, backed up, and pulled out onto the street. She sped away. The man glared across the street in our direction again, but he walked back into the bar. "Jesus, you dumbass. That could have been a bad scene," a man's voice said from below.
"I don't give a damn," the woman responded. "The son of a bitch shouldn't be hitting a woman."
I looked back up the street toward the 7-Eleven. The white, green, and red sign illuminated three teenagers standing on the corner. A robin's egg blue Caprice with shiny spinning wheel covers was just backing up, turning around, and cruising into Monica's lot. "There's real trouble," said a masculine voice from below. The Caprice had come to a stop, but the wheel covers were still spinning. A black man emerged from the front passenger door and another from the rear. The driver stayed in the car with the motor running as the other two men walked toward Monica's door. "Keep your mouth shut no matter what these guys do," the man on the porch pleaded. "They're selling crack and they're..."
"Okay, okay, just shut up and give me a cigarette," the woman interrupted.
In just a few minutes, the two black men came back out with a white man and got into the Caprice. I could see the driver light a cigarette and roll his window down slightly. It didn't take long for the men to take care of business. The back door swung open, and the white man got out and went back into Monica's. The driver tossed his cigarette out the window, pulled out onto 6th Street, and drove away. As I turned to see the blue Caprice speed off, I saw gentleman Jake and three other men approaching John's front steps. One of them was called the Indian. The other two I didn't know.
"Jake, you're drunk,"
I heard a woman say.
"I'm in a bad way," Jake slurred. "You suppose I could sleep on this porch tonight? I just want to be safe."
"There'll probably be a few others," said the woman.
I watched as Jake half collapsed on the steps.
"I fell off the wagon," he said. 2 years without a drink until tonight," he slurred. "But I'm happy now."
He pulled himself back from the window. I had seen enough for tonight. I left the blind up and got back into my sleeping bag. I rolled on my side and closed my eyes.
"It's been 4 years for me, Jake," I heard the woman say. 4 years without a drink, and I'm..."
"Whoa!"
A man screaming across the street interrupted whatever she was saying.
"Whoa!"
I opened my eyes. The sound of Bruce Springsteen pounding from Monica's jukebox ended abruptly, and the light streaming in the window began to dim. Monica's must be closing, I thought to myself. I pictured Monica pulling the plug of the box and turning off the neon lights one by one as she was shooing the customers out the door. I could hear the car door slamming and the engine starting as the patrons began to take their leave.
"Hey, you guys across the street!" a man yelled. "You want a piece of me?"
"Don't say anything," the man's voice below warned quietly.
"I'll whip your ass!"
"Come on, Bob. Leave the poor suckers alone," another voice across the street said. "I'll take you home. Come on, let's go." There was near silence for a moment. Then I heard another door slam and a car starting to pull away. I pulled the sleeping bag over my head. I wondered if there were windows and porches like this in Paris or Berlin, or was this just a piece of Americana, with a room reserved just for me? It must have been sometime after 3 when I finally dozed off. I remembered hearing the voices on the porch becoming more subdued, still talking, but running out of steam. When I opened my eyes and peered out the window, morning had broken, and I could see that it was overcast. I got up slowly, trying not to wake Willow. As I walked over to the window, I checked my watch. It was 8:30. The street was empty except for a car or two passing by. A small ribbon of smoke was still rising off the campfire behind Sally's. All was quiet from the night before. But I knew it would not be for long. It was going to be Saturday Night Live tonight. As I looked out at the street below, morning brought some clarity about the previous night's events. I was homeless, and I knew it was really kind of John to let me stay here. But out this window I had seen much too much in one night. I had seen homeless men sitting by a campfire as if they were in a third world country. I had seen a drug deal, an arrest, and a physical altercation. While I desperately needed a roof over my head, I knew it could not be here, by this window, where I could see the homeless day and night. I could survive watching myself escape into my van in a church parking lot every evening, but seeing others walk the streets without hope every night was just too depressing. I felt that sometime, in some way, some terrible thing was going to happen here. I woke Willow from her sleep and rolled up my sleeping bag. I picked up the bag and Willow and left the room, locking the door behind me. I tiptoed down the stairs and unlocked the front door. There were 6 people, including Jake, sprawled out asleep on the porch. Some were covered only by their coats. Some had no covers at all. I quietly closed the door, took the key John had given me, and turned it carefully in the lock. I slipped the keys back into my pocket, making a mental note to return them as soon as I saw John again. I stepped gingerly over a woman lying directly in my path and then cautiously around another body draped precariously at the top of the steps. I made my descent and covered the short distance to Sally's parking lot. I got in the van and placed Willow on the seat. Pulling out of the lot, I headed toward the water. A block and a half from Sally's, I passed the girders of the new government center rising 5 stories in the air. Then I turned right and passed the construction site of the million-dollar condos and the new convention center. In that block and a half, I had traveled from one world to an entirely different one, and I didn't feel that I understood either of them.
That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The bookshelf is produced by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.